My name is Andreas Droulias. It's the 19th of February 2004, and I'm going to have an interview with Michael Krauss, starting about his personal background, his training, and his reasons for doing the things he did, and the first days and or years that he came to Alaska. So,
yeah, well, my name is Michael Krauss, but I wanted to ask you: you pronounce your name Andreas or
Andreas.
With an N? Can you still put the N in there?
Yeah,
Andreas.
Yeah. In Greek, it would be Andreas.
You could say Andreas.
The.
Not Andreas. Oh, yeah. Oh, Chris, it's not a T. I see. Yeah. Okay. It's Andreas. Oh, okay. Andreas Rudia. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got it. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. I was born August 15th, 1934, in Cleveland, Ohio, of essentially English-speaking parents in an English-speaking family, having almost no experience with any language other than English, until I was sent to Jewish Sunday school, where we started learning Hebrew. And that was a serious issue for me and for my parents, who took it seriously, because they were definitely strongly identified that way, and believed, even though they didn't know much of it, that I should know as much as possible. And because I think also in their upbringing, as certainly in mine, the idea that Hebrew, although until then fairly still recently, had not been anyone's home mother tongue, it was nevertheless a national language, and that language was very essential part of a whole culture, ideology, and identity. The language as such, not just because of what it was said in it, but just its very existence, and therefore that a knowledge of that was a learning that was a part of a culture and a nationhood and identity that was very passionately cultivated. And my parents, although they themselves did not have a good strong background in it or a good strong education in it, were deeply, they agreed with each other entirely that it was an important part, should be an important part of my upbringing, that very notion. And along with that, I suppose also a very important principle that was inculcated into me at the very same time by concrete demonstration. That is possible, in fact, even not plain possible, but essential, at least as an American, and this country being a demonstration thereof, that nationhood is a is not an exclusive taxonomic thing, that people can be two things at once, so to speak. In this case, an American Jew, an American and a Jew, or possibly a Bulgarian and a Turk, or a Greek and a Albanian. I'm not sure about that. But these whole these issues, which have become painful matters in your part of the world and in most parts of the world, that nation statehood is a taxonomic thing, and you can only be, you know, you can't be a dog and a cat at the same time. That's understandable. But as a human being, you could conceivably be an Armenian and an American at the same time, or, God forbid, an Armenian and a Turk at the same time, although it seems like a virtual impossibility. These points, for me, were a very essential part of my upbringing, that nationhood identity is not a strict or in its essential nature, not a taxonomy at all. And that you cannot organize mankind according to some kind of high school outline system, where A2 can't be also B3 or some damn thing. Those are that's a stupid oversimplification and bringing about countless unnecessary tragedies. Although the world's politics is not organized accordingly, so you have to be Iraqi, and the fact that you're Sunni too, well, too bad, or tough luck, or no, there's no Kurdistan at all, but there are people who still insist on being Kurds, often costing their lives. And but in fact, there are very few nation states that have the privilege or misfortune of consisting of entirely one group. I think there's only very few. Uruguay is one, although racially, God only knows what they are, and where there's only one language, really. And there aren't any enclaves of native groups in the country. Iceland, in a sense, is another relatively new artifact, a very interesting one, part of my own background. But anyway, what I'm looking at this point is my mother's milk upbringing, and which included the idea of language as a symbol of, more than a symbol, the essence of nationhood on the one hand, and on the other as an object of interest in itself with the content and so on, was sort of strangely lacking, because the only language I was actually raised with was English. Heard very little, if any, Yiddish, and a few expressions maybe, but that's it. And strictly English in a affluent suburb. My father was a medical general surgeon, and so I was raised in a relatively privileged suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, where one did not continually run into other languages, because these were mostly then well-established people, although, yes, there were refugees and others who spoke with an accent, but nobody who openly practiced speaking Polish on the street.
Could you tell me your the names of your parents?
My father's name is Lester Krauss, mother Ethel Sklarsky Krauss. Mm-hmm. They both died in an auto accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike in 1960, after I'd moved here. I had a relatively uneventful childhood, but can recall it well for some reason. I have a good ear. I'm very much oriented toward oral A-U-R-A-L experiences, much more than visual in a way, and I was given some pretty good musical training, and for some reason or other also had a strong interest in other languages. When I ever heard them, my ears always perked up, and I can recall one event where I got into a little trouble walking on my way to school past a place where there were some men digging in a ditch, probably to fix a sewer pipe or something, and they were talking some other language, definitely not English, and going by, I heard them doing this, and I remember standing there for the longest time pretending as though I were watching the work, but really just listening to them talk. It was so fascinating, and to this day, I don't know, no way I will ever find out whether that was Italian or Polish or what, but it was definitely something that riveted my attention so much so that I stood there long enough to end up being late for school that day and getting into trouble. But that was the way I've always been. That kind of thing attracts me, and I sure wished I could understand them, and still do.
Was it near your area?
Yeah, it was on my way walking from my house to my school. And these men, no doubt from a different part of town,
right,
were working on some underground
But you
project.
Said you didn't have many foreigners in
No, not living with us. We would be exposed to on a daily basis,
okay. But
only on an incidental basis like that. But I remember being, therefore, very fascinated by that and very attracted to it, basically. So I was good at English too, and I was an excellent speller and so on, but so I have facility for language. The only other language that I ever had any contact with before, any study of before puberty actually, was Latin, which I did very well with in high school and can still remember that. Or junior high school, but part of the Jewish upbringing too was that not only gave me some interest and respect for the function of language as a vehicle and essence of a culture and identity in a nation, but also and of the non-taxonomic nature of the human condition, and any illusion that mankind is taxonomically pigeonholable is a very bad mistake. And the source of a lot of unnecessary tragedy that we're going to have to start getting used to. But also, from that point of view, I also had surely inculcated into me the idea of perhaps the most successful experience, ideas of the most successful experience in survival as a minority, and the survival of minorities maybe ordinarily persecuted because of that, of course. And it was always therefore finding myself perhaps as a minority type of person, and I don't know if you know this word, we're talking about dogs, underdog, you know the word underdog, okay. That I've always been much more interested in underdog, minority, persecuted people than majority persecuting peoples. And that basic principle has definitely stayed with me all my life, going in full circles from beginning to end. That's definitely a basic principle. So I have been at the same time also repelled by the majority type of arrogance and smug senses of superiority. I find that extremely unattractive. Pride in oneself, of course, but arrogance, smugness, and feeling of superiority to everything else, as though mankind were organized also according to qualities which are definitely linear in terms of power. So that the implicit, if not explicit, pride or arrogance of the Anglo-Saxon, or what once was Anglo-Saxon, no longer is merely Anglo-Saxon, sense of superiority and manifest destiny in empire, including the use of English, of course, which after all is just another language, isn't it? Over a master at the very top of the language of the vertical organization of mankind, at the very crown jewel then of humanity, must be the Anglo-Saxon swineherd at one time, now being emperor of the earth, and that notion as manifest in Alaska, which we're still dealing with, and which large parts of the world are still dealing with, and if not in the form of English, then in the form of Russian, or God only knows what, at one point, I suppose, Attic Greek even, too, the idea that mankind is organized with oneself at the top and everything else in various levels beneath that is not a very good way to, at least not my way of perceiving mankind, but as a fascinating, endless variety, let us hope, of different ways of talking and thinking and understanding our very interesting common humanity and our universe.
Right. So,
so these are, say, the basic ideologies or ways of looking at the world that I grew up with, both as certain positive ways and in certain negative ways that repelled me. Mm-hmm. And the negative ways that repelled me, certainly Shaker Heights, where I was raised, fancied itself as probably the pinnacle in its own little way of privilege and civilization of the American Empire. And all other things a distance or two beneath. And I think rebelled at that and found myself becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the smug stability of that little society, and was already getting in with reputedly bad company. Some of the Italian boys or something that were not the right kind to associate with, because it was so much more interesting and to me broadening than the narrow circle in which I was could have been raised. But still, I was becoming less and less well adjusted to those strictures, and by the time I was 2 years before the finish of high school in 10th grade, it was a great relief to discover that I was admitted to the University of Chicago, then still under the Hutchins system of early admission from the, directly from the 10th grade, skipping the last 2 years of high school, and went off to college at the University of Chicago. Then in the year 1950, I just turned 16, and unfortunately that summer also discovering some of the delights of relations with the opposite sex, fallen madly in love with a girl from New York, which was rather awkward since I was headed for Chicago. So while trying, having skipped two grades and gone to the University of Chicago, where I promptly skipped another grade because instead of the usual T's and orientation programs and dances, they put a packet of papers on your bed in your cell in the dormitory, and one of the papers was, I remember, a mathematical theory of braids and various other things of which I had absolutely no notion. I was told to read that stuff and take placement examinations. That was our first week there. I read the stuff, and it was a hell of a challenge. I never really had to use my brain before, it seemed, except to stave off boredom. And suddenly, this was one hell of a challenge. The result of which was that I found myself skipped yet another year by being exonerated from any requirements in any field for which I had any talent, namely any language work, any mathematics, any music or humanities, so that nothing was left there for me to study except stuff I had absolutely no talent for, whatever, American history, physics, chemistry, and so on. I say no talent, but the things for which I had shown obviously the least interest. So I was left with a diet of almost nothing that was really that meaningful or fascinating to me. Instead of 4 years, 3 years, I was graduated from this entirely, literally entirely, formulated course with no electives, as the educated modern Leonardo, I guess, unable, however, to do anything useful or interesting. But more smugly than ever, then managed to outsmart myself all the way through college to graduate at the age of 18, I guess, yeah, ready to start a life as I knew not what. I spent 1 year after that back home in Cleveland getting another bachelor's degree, which I took French and Italian. and nothing else for one whole year, which was a very pleasant return for me to my roots, so to speak, after, I guess, in that sense, sufficient emancipation. The New York girlfriend lasted for over a year, during which I took odd jobs as a night clerk at a hotel until I fell asleep on the job, and as a bank bookkeeper in order to earn money for extra fare, for plane fares to travel back and forth over Cleveland from between Chicago and New York. That added to the adventure, but not to the success of that enterprise. And so it was anyway, by the time I got out of that and then the extra year in Cleveland, it became clearer than ever to me that my main interest and talent lay in the direction of language. And having studied French and Italian, and one course in linguistics from Raven Ivor MacDavid, was a remarkable fine linguist and specialist in American dialectology, American English dialectology. That was my beginning in that. And what I got to, of course, in speech, too. The only thing I can remember about that was that I learned right away phonetic transcription, and that the instructor was still living in the very house in which he was born. Right. After no doubt 30 some years, but the those things were so easy for me, and yet so interesting, and yet not enough that I went on then for a master's degree at New York, at Columbia, which I loved. And
what year was that?
This was in the year 1953-54. No, 53, 54 was, I graduated the University of Chicago in 1953 with a degree in liberal arts, no major. And then in 1954 with a major in French or Romance languages. And then went on, I remember I started French having spent a summer, part of a summer, learning to read it. So I never had French 100 maybe, but I definitely had French 200 and French 300. And French 200 was largely literature, and French 300 was advanced syntax or something like that. And I persuaded, bless that university, they allowed me to take, without having French 100, take French 200 and French 300 at the same time. And I'm very proud to say that I got an A in French 300 and a B in French 200.
Right.
Very symptomatic of the nature of my interests and talents as being far more in linguistics than in literature itself. Yeah, 200, I think, was a survey of French literature or something like that. And then I took Italian from a lovely lady by the name of Barricelli, who came from a remarkable family of patriots and a very central pillar to the Italian community settled near the university, and a lady of very high culture. And I took, I think, French, Italian 200, and of course all in Italian too, with her on reading the Inferno. We never graduated past the Inferno, but that was, of course, the most interesting part of the whole trilogy anyway, and she was a grand lady, and under that family name there's still a very, very, very fine restaurant in, near the university in the neighborhood there, still known as Little Italy. So I was already, I was still interested. I did not take Russia, the major language competing with English for world dominance at the time, or anything like that. I was interested in relatively harmless languages, seemingly so, at that time. No one had offered me a course in Sicilian, God forbid, or Patois, God forbid, which I would have jumped at with even probably greater alacrity.
And your interest in, was it focused on European language mostly?
What other languages are there?
Oh, right.
I mean, there aren't any others.
Right.
So I had no, and I was not interested in something that was barely European anyway, like Russian, because it was a language of the conquering, of the imperialist hordes. And at the same time, I never had any interest even in learning to speak a language to sound like one of these people, unless it was an underdog language, Italian, and especially the kind that the wrong kind of boys spoke, namely Sicilian. But that didn't go over very well in standard Italian courses. So I always had a certain flavor to my interest in languages that way. And that was virtually the end of my real interest or mastery of any Italian and French, of any so-called standard languages that I actually wanted to learn to speak well enough to sound like a native speaker or to pass as a native speaker. Yes.
All right. We go back to our discussion. I wanted to ask you if the whole ideology you described was explicit to you back then. I mean, was that your drive, or the drive was a little bit more innate?
I think all of these ideas about the non-taxonomical nature of human variety on the one hand, politics, ideologies, no, all of that was merely implicit, and some of it is, even as we speak now, coming out as clearly as it has for the first time. Mm-hmm. So this is, even to me, believe it or not, is an enlightening opportunity for me to see what has driven me in these strange directions all these years.
Right.
So ultimately ending up even in conflict with the very institution for which I've worked for the last 40-some years.
Right. So we were in the University of Columbia.
Columbia. Columbia.
Right. And then you were there. You went in what date? A year?
1950. 54, 55.
Okay, that I got.
And that was that 1 year only.
All right, and it was for a master's.
And it was for it was the third year in a row that I got a new degree after 1 year.
Mm, okay.
What attracted me, I think, to Columbia, was the worldwide fame of one Mario Pei. He had scholarly virtues himself, But he was actually, had only, I knew nothing, had no real professional advisement of any kind from anyone at the University of Chicago or at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, where I got my second BA. Maybe a little bit from McDavid, Raven McDavid, who recognized some talent, I guess, and certainly did attract me implicitly, you know, probably, who took me seriously. Which meant, you know, I had some ability in this direction, although it was still never, you know, full mentorship or advice on what to do with my life. This has been, just as all of this was implicit, my life, I guess, in certain respects, has been self-invented. Mm-hmm. Made it up as I went along, and still am.
Did you want advice? Did you ask for advice?
I don't think I asked for advice either. Probably I was too both rebellious and arrogant a young man, and extremely unattractive as to anybody with fatherly or paternal instincts. Things wanting to guide me in a direction where I might do the most good, or something. It was beyond my parents, who were very well-meaning and all of that. It was beyond their technical capabilities. My mother was college-educated too, but still not in a way to advise me professionally. And although my father did want me to go into medicine, but that was clear that that was not what I was most interested in myself.
What was the job of your parents? What?
My father was a surgeon, and he had invited me, in fact had me, in a white suit and a white gown, and watching him operate and so on. And I wasn't repelled by it, but I wasn't excited by it either. And also it's a hard life to be a doctor who cares about his patients and therefore have to worry yourself sick all the time and to take it out on your kids at dinner time because you just went into somebody and he's full of cancer or something, and take your home, make care about your work enough to take it home with you, as I always have. I wanted to do that with a job that was much more pleasant, because mm-hmm. I guess I never did learn to separate my work place and my life, and I always put my life into my work, and so I always took it home with me, I guess the way my poor father did too, but at least I was smart enough not to do it with something that would weighty and altruistic, as worrying about other people's health and one's responsibility for it. He had great skill and took great responsibility, but at what cost?
And I was
not attracted to them. My mother was a proper housewife. And helpmate to him and raising her children and professional in the community. But one of the fateful things, I think I said on the other tape to either of you, was that my father at the same time, probably looking at my mother when I said, Dad, gee, I'd love to take typing, probably with a glance toward her, because she was a good typist. Said, you don't need to do that, son. You'll have a secretary. Yeah, sure. UAF provides secretaries.
So we are in the university now of Colombia.
Yeah.
And you did what there?
Well, I went there originally to get a degree in, for whatever good it was going to do, called Romance Philology. Yeah, okay, we're stopping for a second here.
Okay. So, University of Columbia.
Yeah, Columbia University. Mm-hmm. New York City. Well, I did take classes and did get a degree in romance philology, all right, it is true. I, at the same time, started taking linguistic courses, one after the other, from André Bartini, who was then a man in his, I suppose, 40s, and a wonderful linguist, and a fine teacher. And I took courses in Indo-European and what all else. Everything that I could from him during that 1 year that I was there, including in the evenings or in the late afternoons, once a week, a course in classical Greek. We used to go over to his apartment, two or three students, and read with him classical Greek, not a grammar book or anything, but studying straight out with the Anabasis.
Okay.
And we got to Othalata, Othalata. And that was the pinnacle of my Greek career. This Pternute? Pternute.
Pternute.
Yeah, someone sneezed.
Ah, right. Okay.
Do you still use that word, pternute?
No.
Oh. Ah, shucks. That's
now
the only Greek
it
I remember.
Has changed. It's a fee, it's pternizome.
Oh.
Yeah. Pternute. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I recognize it now.
Yeah, okay. And which I guess then meant that there was, that was a great sign of a momentous occasion. And sure enough, they somebody ahead of him in line saw the sea.
Okay.
And they were rescued. They escaped from Turkey, as
right.
usual,
yeah.
of the Greeks.
<That's true. laughs>
Come to think of it. And then I thought, oh, wow, now I'm ready to read any Greek. And I hauled out some Plato or something. And
but
damn it, I couldn't read one sentence.
Right.
But I always respected Greek as a is a fine dialect of Indo-European. It's perfectly good Indo-European, and so for that reason, at least, I appreciate Greek. That is Attic Greek, and I forgot whatever happened. There was one other kind of Greek that about 300 speakers left of, and the name of it will come. But it's the only survival of non-Attic Greek, Doric Greek, or something.
I don't know.
You wouldn't know because, being a real Greek,
yeah.
Who the hell would care about those poor souls? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. And, but that's, and I'm ashamed that suddenly I can't remember the name of the dialect of which that is still, maybe still has a few speakers left.
Right.
The only non-Attic Greek. To survive. You would think that that would be a national treasure for all Greeks, but no.
Right.
They want to make sure that those kids don't have some funny accent when they grow up speaking proper Greek.
Right.
And that's where I come in.
Right, thank you.
Anyway, Martinet was a real eye-opener for me, and he is the man who definitely attracted me into linguistics.
Okay, let me stop here because...
Yeah.
André Martinet.
Yeah. Martinet was the closest thing I could say I ever had to a mentor or an orientation to linguistics, and I could never, nevertheless, he comes closer than anyone else to being the formative personality in my approach to linguistics in a certain way, in part because, although he was certainly a marvelous linguist in all the respects I cared about, which included mastery in a variety of languages, but also an interest in linguistics historically and an interest in linguistics as a discipline and theory. But it's that broad. It's not that he was specifically exclusively a theorist, for sure, or exclusively a descriptivist, for sure, or exclusively a language learner, for sure, or exclusively a historian comparativist, either. He was all of those things put together, and that kind of approach, which in certain somewhat different ways comes closer to Sapir. Of course, I never met, he died when I was 5 years old, but whose approach to languages mine resembles probably more than anybody else. Certainly not Chomsky or any theoretician, and certainly, although politically, in a unified way for me, in a Chomsky totally bifurcated way, linguistics as a theory on the one side, or as a biological theory on the one side, is very important, and even as a philosophy, a scientific philosophy. On the other side, there is the activist critic of our politics also that motivates him, but the two in me go completely together and him completely apart, if I may make any comparisons of that type. But Martinet was a very wonderful circumstance for me. That he was there in, at Columbia at the time, and what during that year turned out also to be his last year at Columbia, which resulted in then in my continuing the next year to study with him in France. So that's how I went abroad, and I was plenty ready for it by then. I had that one very successful year in where I got my degree, all right, in Romance Philology, I believe it was called. But what I really got imbued with was a broad approach to linguistics that Martinet stood for, and with which I had become totally fascinated, and it was therefore a I applied for a French government scholar bourse to continue studying with him at the University of Paris, Sorbonne, and l'École des Hautes Études there, and continued my study that year in Paris. We're now talking 55, 56. Yeah. In as a boursier of the French government, which was none too luxurious, but which enabled me to live, albeit it is true, on the West Bank. And then I had a distant relative whose apartment sat at Neuilly for part of that year, and but I spent the year anyway in Paris. Ironically, or not so ironically, I made another transition there, however, into my own direction by being perhaps less interested in continuing my study with Martinet himself, although it was all under him and with his encouragement. But I became at the same time fascinated by courses in Celtic under Edouard Bachelieret. Bachelieret fought in World War II. I don't know exactly how, but ended up being wounded and taken care of by a Welsh-speaking nurse, whom he then married and lived in Paris with speaking Welsh and raising their children in Paris in Welsh. And from there it was just another step to Breton, and from there to Gaelic, and so on. And that's where I came in. I fell under the spell of that, of course, in Old Irish and Old Welsh, and in fact, I think I saw in comparative Celtic or something like that. I remember we went through Holger Pedersen's Vergleich der Grammatik der keltischen Sprachen, and or rather the English abridgment of that, and other things. And I loved Bachelieret's approach to it, and became utterly fascinated with Irish in that class in Sorbonne. And so it was not a coincidence either that the following year I went immediately to Ireland. Stopped in Dublin at the, oh, after was it? Yeah, a summer, 57, yes. It was a fateful summer. Summer of 1957, so it was 1955, 56. I was in, no, yeah, I'm wrong. 1955-56, I was in France, mm-hmm. And then, and another thing that had begun to fascinate me, but was still beyond the limits for many reasons, beyond the limits and beyond. Well, Breton itself was enough beyond the limits, because in France at the time, Breton, and still is, was very much being persecuted out of existence, the French not tolerating any language but French being spoken in France. And so the battle between the Celtic and the French was still going on. Rather fiercely, and it was definitely not a popular thing to do, and not an attractive thing to do, for example, for me to go to Brittany, and start talking, trying to learn Breton there, because except for a few strange people who probably had their heads shaved in 1946 due to a lack of French patriotism under the Germans, some of whom were exiled to Ireland, by the way, people in Brittany, any Bretons I would manage to find in Paris, for example. I did find one Scottish Gaelic speaker there, by the way, it was very interesting, but Bretons were very reticent and could not imagine really honestly why anyone would want to learn such a worthless language as Breton, unless perhaps they were a communist spy. No one would want to learn Breton.
Okay.
And these things which attracted me. And also living in Neuilly, but not really being able to afford, except for free, the apartment and so on, I spent a fair amount of time in the zone, industrial belt around the outskirts of Paris and the outskirts of Paris itself, where you go into a cafe or a bistro at night, and chances are there'll be a guy with a kind of brown skin there playing a violin on his knee or in some very unorthodox position with some very unorthodox music because of the Algerian War, which was going on and which was raging at the time, the Algerian conflict. And so I began to understand a lot more just exactly about the costs of the, what is the word, consequences of empire.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to, was becoming keenly aware of that, or learning, trying to speak some Wolof from some Senegalese and so on. I mean, there were lots of very interesting people around, but my interest, instead of getting involved in Wolof and blacks or Arabic, which is its own imperialistic language, and Muslims and so on, I or the minority, difficult minority situation, still there in France, worse than ever. It was just in its formational period at that time. And I look back on it, see going off into Ireland and Gaelic instead was much more my own direction. I mean, I now deal and work with lots of people that I deeply respect, like Matthias Prenzinger and others who work in much more godforsaken places than I ever have. Parts of Africa where people are killing each other left and right, and you don't even have to be a Boer or whatever they are, not, South African. Or certain kind of Angolan to start doing in the or doing nasty things to the, what's left of the Khoisan speakers. Mm-hmm. And in horrible places like that that are full of massacre and famine and AIDS now to boot, that has not attracted me as much as the, you might say, down-home Anglo-Saxon conflict with Celtic, which is still going on in Wales and Ireland. So that's what attracted me, and most specifically Irish. Immediately went to Ireland in the summer fall of 56.
Mm-hmm.
And got a, I think it was all of 50 pounds or 150 pounds, I can't remember. Something, anyway, fellowship from the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies in Dublin to go study the dialect of Inis Mihain, the middle of the three Aran Islands in Galway Bay. And it was enough to take care of my economic needs, especially since I was ready and willing to participate in island life. And appreciate that institute then on Merrion Square in Dublin. It had two schools, two divisions: study of school of cosmic physics on the one hand, and the school of I think it was called Celtic languages or Gaelic linguistics on the other. Just those two things: cosmic physics and Gaelic. Naturally, I was in the Gaelic division and was sent off to well endowed with the works of Tomás de Walder and Gaelic, recently minted on Gaelic, Creshadig or Connemara Irish phonology and Connemara Irish morphology, and some of the pedagogical grammars of the Christian Brothers, most particularly, I think, which I, so to speak, religiously went through the exercises of. And in my spare time in the house, I lived in two households on that island. It's the most isolated of the three Aran Islands, being the middle one, and with the, in those days, the poorest landing facility, so that you could only get there by climbing off the steamer into a carach and row through the breakers ashore. And at that time, there was still virtually no electricity, no running water, no combustion engines or even wheeled vehicles, like horse carts, hardly. It was all still basically subsistence. Which meant a lot of potatoes in particular, some fish, especially on Friday night. That was a big banquet, because all other nights being meatless, Friday night at least you had fish. And it was a to me, I think maybe the most formative period of my life. It was exactly the conversion I was headed for, where I completely forsook all modern 20th century conveniences for a life that was still, to these people, very meaningful and entirely Irish, including entirely Irish speaking. No one there ever affected to English speech at the time, except sometimes you would, to a dog, you might say, "Goat!"
Okay.
But it was never anything but Irish to anybody there. And they all spoke, were born, raised, and schooled in Irish. And there were even some monolinguals there, even in my own age category. So there are young men than my age who really could not, at that time, carry on a conversation in English, although I'm sure that most of them could have understood it, or scraped by if they ever left the island. Some never did, but it was a population at that time, 200 something. and still all, you know, beautifully kept whitewashed stone cottages with thatched roofs, and people living off the land as they were. And the heating, in fact, was, and cooking was, yes, a lot of it was indeed beautiful smelling. I still can smell the aroma of that peat or turf fires in the fire, big fireplace with a fire chimney corner seats to sit in and spend all night chatting in Gaelic, and people had real lives that were still entirely based on Celtic tradition, which was heavily, of course, entirely Catholic, and I developed some close relationships with a particular one member of the opposite sex, whom I'm still very devoted, and who did ask me, I think it was she, or maybe it was somebody else that asked me, Protestants, are they Christian too? I was able, I think, to answer that question, at least, right, sort of, but it was, you know, a sense of at least tolerance, not that the Protestants are devils, but Protestants, that's an exotic thing. I've heard of them, but are they Christian? Or, and there was a certain kindliness there, and a certain tolerance, and I enjoyed their privilege of company of people like that, who are, you know, to me, real people with no few with pretenses, and still wore traditional clothing even, and their existence was not comfortable, but it was secure enough, and they had their, you know, they were proud to be who they were, and continued speaking their way. And I would say there, more than anywhere else, I became so deeply involved in that, both personally, I have to take this call, I'm sorry.
So, yeah.
So I developed a deep personal respect and affection for these people, and maybe more than I ever had anywhere else, at least until then, given the kind of life that I'd led, and the kind of person that I turned out to be. And I damn near never left the place, and in certain still very significant respects, have never left the place. And that call it a simple life if you want, but because certainly materialistically it was, but yeah, in other words, they didn't have too many toys to distract themselves with. So there was little materialism, but a deep spirituality that in my view makes the nicest kind of people. I remember times, they were always very patient with me, and but I remember one sort of key occasion in which they began maybe to show a little, I don't know the word, impatience or something with me, or maybe were making fun of me or something for making some mistake in speech or something or other. And I said, gee, I'm just learning, you know, and I think I allowed myself to say, you know, there's a lot of things that I, in my life, that you guys don't know about either, and barely took even those syllables to straighten everything out to the point where, I mean, they understood, you know, and I understood that this is the best kind of way of interacting. And I learned more from them, I'm afraid, of course, than they ever learned from me. But, and I guess I will go way out of chronology here. I had gotten so that when we even so much as went to the mainland, you could see the mainland from there, but it was a different world still. And although directly across, there were the hooker boats you could go across on, it was still rather different world, although still entirely Gaelic speaking. But I would be disoriented and not used to talk. The dialect sounded a little different, and I didn't feel quite so at home, and I clung to the few islanders that had come across with me and for the few evenings that I was there. And even little things like the exquisite directional sense. So, for example, where I was sitting in the chimney corner, which, by the way, there's no people who sit in the chimney corner are, you know, all the time are no good. But your dinner is west on the table, and so you go to mainland and everything is turned around or some damn thing, and what do you say? If I do it here, I was disoriented.
Yeah.
And I had so well adjusted to that spot, and as I say, in some ways I almost never left it. But I recall that the in the mainland, where people didn't know us all, that the people just took it for granted that I was another islander, and they never realized that I was an outsider, and I had actually gotten to talk Irish. I'm sure not in every situation, presumably, although there aren't that many different kinds of situations. So that I had the native-like, sounded like a native speaker of the language, and I always had, you know, good accent if I wanted to. The same never true of Russian or German at all. In fact, more nastily I can speak languages like that, pure functionality, and that's all, you know. If I screw up with a case ending or something, all the better. They can understand me all right. I never wanted to sound like one of them, you know. But there it was a completely different thing, and I was totally involved, totally. And then, so much so that I said that I had a hard time pulling myself out of there. But then I went back there only once, in 1985, I think it was, 30-some years after, and 30 years. And my Gaelic was all rotted away, or seemingly, although by the end of a week it was halfway back at the very least. I was there for about a week, and but I remember meeting an old man on one of the boarding, the alley street walks between the stone walls of the all over the island, and the old man said hello in the usual polite way. I answered him, and we got to talking, and he said, you know, you talk pretty good Irish, but 20, 30 years ago, there was this young American fella, Mickey Lean was his name, And boy, did he ever have the Gaelic. His Irish was just, he sounded just like us. And I tried to explain that was indeed, I was the very same fellow.
Right.
And he said, oh, no, that, that's totally impossible. And this fellow is a lot thinner than you, too, by the way. my hair by then all gray, of course. And anyhow, that really brought it out to me what time had done. But it wouldn't have been long before I gotten back into it, and I mean, come right back. And so that was that's out of sequence here. Anyway, that year I stayed in the house of Martin Og and his wife for some months, and it wasn't until I was about to leave that household that I realized that I found out that the wife had spent 20 years in Boston working in factories or as a some kind of laborer there, and I don't know to this day if she knew any English or not, but had come back obviously during the Depression and was one of the what they call punk on the people who had migrated back from Boston to the islands during that vintage of the 30s. And this is only 20 years later. And in any case, after they had somebody coming back from into their house, I moved to another, to the house of Martin Fat Anthony, who was another grand fellow with a couple of sons and a daughter living in the house, it was a bigger house, and I lived and worked there, and became deeply involved not only with them, but also with Marty Humash, a woman who is now one of the leaders of the island industry, cottage industry, and outstanding personage who last time I saw her name in public, it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, where some reporter had visited this island in a special kind of feature, and they were at that time in the throes of deciding whether or not they were going to build a pier at which steamers could land and bring tourists. Who would stay in their bed and breakfast homes and overrun the island with tourists, mm-hmm. and English-speaking tourists from all kinds of countries. And there was quite some controversy on the island, and the reporter picked up on that, and he consulted Martin, of course, on that. And the last thing I saw written from her, from her mouth, was that we may have to do it, but I'm better to die as a true Irish, an Irish speaker, than try to convert ourselves into something that we're not, and. There was a kindred spirit, all right, I must say. But it's ironic that I should hear that from her on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, of all places on earth.
Right.
But, anyway, there were a lot of Irish in Boston from that very island, and I decided that I would apply to Harvard to finish my doctoral degree or just stay there for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I got word back from Harvard.
All right. So, we were in the application to Harvard.
Yeah, okay. I had applied to Harvard, and I for there were two reasons. One, because there were a lot of Irish in Boston, and two, because Harvard, maybe alone at those days of American universities, had a Celtic program as well as linguistics. And I applied to Celtic and for interdisciplinary degree in Celtic and linguistics. And got word that I not only was accepted there, but was even given a stipendium to finish, and that was too irresistible to resist, and I therefore found myself very sadly saying goodbye to the island and its people, in particular Maureen, not knowing what my fate was going to be and whether I would return or what. So I went off from there to Harvard. And I found in certain ways that the linguistics was okay. There were some things going on there, although there were more things in 1957. In 1956-57, I was in Ismailing. And by the way, also, I could not make any money there to get a trip back home. I went to, I forgot to leave, put this in. I left there in the spring of 57 or early summer and went to Norway. And got a job at Studentbyen Pasong, which is the dormitory area of the university, which turns into a summer hotel for tourists during the time. Got a job on the garbage unit there to drive garbage to collect garbage and, from the hotel and take to the garbage dump where everyone spoke Norwegian. So that gave me a chance to sharpen up my Norwegian and actually start becoming fluent in the Scandinavian language, which were of some interest to me.
And so let me ask something. In Ireland, you spent only the summer of...
Oh, no. I spent the whole year of 56, 57.
Seven. So in Harvard...
I was over a year there on the island, basically.
Okay. So in Harvard, you
with
went
a little time in Dublin. Yeah.
In academic year of 57-58 in Harvard.
Yes.
Okay.
Is that correct? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It has to be. Yeah. Which, by the way, was the year that 2 miles down the street at Massachusetts Avenue, Noam Chomsky had just published his Syntactic Structures bombshell. And
in Norway, you went on?
This was the summer between Ireland and my emergence from that world into the modern economy and the need to earn enough money to buy a ticket for the steamship home. And which I did by working as a garbage man at the summer hotel version of the my student university dormitory, and to take in while I was at it the International Congress of Linguists, which was taking place in Oslo that year. And that's where I made a lot of important contacts, and most important of all, and most fateful of all, with Knut Bergsland, than the University of Oslo, and a specialist in Sami and Finno-Ugric languages, but also at the time too, also the leading scholar of Eskimo Aleut, and especially Aleut studies.
Did you present a paper there?
No, I was working. Although I think I worked as an usher or something there for the week that thing went on, but the rest of the summer I spent earning money for my steamship ticket home, and in Norwegian. I got a work permit in Norway and made enough money to buy that, and went to from there to straight to Harvard, and. The linguistics was no great eye-opener for me. I did do the reading and so on under Joshua Whatmo, who was himself a specialist in Celtic Gaulish phonology, philology, and so on, but most important in certain ways of my associations at Harvard. Were, strangely enough, and this might put me in a very small category of students, I found that I appreciated Harvard for the qualities of its custodial staff as much as its faculty. Ironically, because the true skills in Gaelic, Irish, were a number of the custodial staff who knew far more Irish than any of the faculty, that's for sure, and who in certain ways were a different kind of Harvard man. And although there were a few fine faculty people there, like Charlie Ferguson and Paul Friedrich, Ferguson is dead now, but Friedrich is still alive, that I most appreciated. But and my only other faculty appreciation was down the street at MIT, where I met a few of the people starting to work with Chomsky back way back then, but. I certainly didn't get in on that ground floor because I was headed in an entirely different direction, which was much more like sociolinguistics, minority linguistics, and so on. And true, I got my degree there, but I doubt if anybody, even on my committee, really read my dissertation or understood it. So they basically rubber stamped my. Contribution to Irish Gaelic phonology and orthography, which is a practical issue in a certain way of interest to me, on the qualities of Irish Gaelic orthography, how logical it is that f could be spelt M-H-T-H, and spells F. For example, or E-Y is spelled O-I-D-H-C-H-E-M-H-A-I-T-H, good night, if that's a good example of, a good enough example of the mysteries of Irish phonology, and which did, in certain ways, make me appreciate more what was going on at MIT, too. And I had a couple of, alas, two abortive contacts with Roman Jakobson there, but at Harvard and with some of the MIT people, especially Morris Halle. I'm sure still, you might say, unfulfilled potentials, but Halle's still very much alive, although Jakobson's long gone. I had some good contacts there, but certainly keen competition for the best was with some of the custodial staff, which puts me in a, I think, rather very small category of students for right. Harvard. And I was I left there in the summer, finished the dissertation, I think,